Welcome, everybody. This is Mark Steiner. We're about to talk about this conference coming to Morgan State University tomorrow called Breaking the Silence, Baltimore Town Hall on Women and Girls of Color. One of the conveners of that is Rachel Gilmore, who is Associate Director of the African American Policy Forum, coming down from New York. And in the studio is also Dr. Annika Simpson, who is Associate Professor of Philosophy and Religious Studies here at Morgan State University and Coordinator of the University's Women and Gender Studies Program. Dr. Jared Ball is joining us, Associate Professor in the School of Global Journalism and Communication and co-editor of Malcolm X, A Live Reinvention, and author of I Mix What I Like, A Mixtape Manifest. It can be found online at imixwhatilike.org. Good to have the three of you with us.
Thank you.
Rachel,
thanks for having us.
I'm glad you all are here, and I'm glad this is coming to Morgan. let's start, Rachel. I want you to describe a bit about why this conference is taking place and why you're coming down from New York to do this.
Sure. So if we look at the conversation on racial justice, all the way from, you know, the White House's My Brother's Keeper initiative down to the grassroots movement that we see build around the death of, Trayvon Martin and Mike Brown and Eric Garner, we see a racial justice narrative in which we framed men, black men and boys, as the primary targets of racial injustice, which is true. Black men and boys are targets of racial injustice, but that leaves a huge gap and a myth that black women and girls are not also at risk. And so we launched a national town hall series to really push back on this idea and to create spaces for women and girls of color, specifically black women and girls, to talk about what they're going through and talk about the various challenges they experience, some of which are similar to what men and boys experience and some of which are vastly different. So we've held these town halls in Los Angeles, in New York, in Atlanta, in Chicago, and just most recently last Monday in Washington, D.C., and then on Saturday, we'll be in Baltimore. So looking forward to bringing young women and girls in the community to talk about what they're going through and for the public to really gain a deeper understanding. Because I think, you know, there's just this, you know, a lot of the issues that are specific to women of color, such as rape and domestic violence, we don't talk about at all because they implicate, you know, other folks within the community. So this is an opportunity to break the silence on issues that are often, women and girls are often stigmatized for talking about.
So, Annika, I mean, and so why here at Morgan, and what are you bringing to this?
I think historically, black colleges and universities have been bedrocks for institutional change and leading civil rights movement. So I think it is of vital importance that we bring this national conversation to Morgan State University. And it also touches upon the work that is central to our Women and Gender Studies program here, which is bringing to the fore issues that face women and girls of the African diaspora. So from our perspective, working within Women and Gender Studies, that lens is primarily of white women and Eurocentric perspectives. So it's important for us to bring race into the conversation and then looking at what Rachel was just talking about, when you're looking at racial justice, and then say we need to bring this feminist perspective along with that too.
You know, I would like to delve into here. I want to bring Jared in from right here, but I want to delve into what these stories are and what we're talking about and the power of stories. I think because sometimes I think for the problem, Jared, is that, and we've talked in this program before about that it's always that we, men, don't talk about these things enough, especially when it comes to women, when it comes to who we are in our relationship with women, our attitude towards women.
You know, I was thinking just as you were posing the question that the only instances I can recall where sort of an organic conversation with men comes up around the condition of women is maybe not the only, but a majority of the time in my experience, it's almost always around men in a very masculine conversation about our defense of women. In other words, what we will do as men once something happens to our women, as opposed to what is happening to the women as the central focus. So I was just thinking about that. And I think it's important that we do work to center the stories and experiences of women, that we as men raise our voices in defense of not only what's happening to women on such a regular basis, but our complicit role in it and our silence around it. And as I was just sharing just a moment ago, that our centering of our own, you know, raising it only to talk about our own masculinity. I mean, it's it, uh, Or often enough, I don't want to just say, you know, or maybe that's just my narrow circle. But I mean, you know, that does seem to happen quite often. So I'm happy to be supporting it, to be supporting this and to see it happening, because it's essential. And the women who are, you know, victims not only of the violence of men just in general, but the violence in the family, the rape in the family, but of what's going on, the big topic right now, the police violence, doesn't get the same attention that goes to the men and the boys.
You know, we talked yesterday on the program about the death of Freddie Gray in Baltimore City at the hands of the police. And several of the panelists are talking about that. The story we're not talking about also is what happens to women in our community at the hands of the police, who are manhandled, who are handcuffed, who are beaten or sat on the same way men are. It's not just men who are the target of police. It's women as well, in increasing numbers. Mm-hmm. Increasing numbers.
Yeah.
So I want you, Rachel, let's begin talking a bit about the power of these stories and what you're hearing, what Annika's hearing, and you know what you know, and then we can share some as well. But I'm curious to begin talking about the power of these stories.
Yeah, so I think, you know, what's really amazing about the face is that we kind of create a lifespan conversation about what happens to black women and girls from girlhood to womanhood. One of the big focuses is on education. You know, we've seen a school-to-prison pipeline discourse that, again, has largely focused on boys and hasn't looked at the ways that girls are also criminalized in schools. We came out with a report recently called Black Girls Matter that looked at this issue. And what we did is we looked at the relationship between black girls being disciplined in relation to white girls and black boys in relation to white boys, because black boys are disciplined in such greater numbers than any other group that black girls have sort of gotten lost in the narrative. But boys across the board are disciplined more. So it's almost better to look within gender as opposed to be comparing within race.
Mm-hmm.
And what we found was that black girls are actually more likely to be disciplined in relation to white girls at 6 times than black boys in relation to white boys at 3 times. So we really need to think about intersectional ways to look at the data to help us actually gain a deeper understanding of what we're seeing. We also talked to girls, and what we found is that black girls are being disciplined for subjective behavioral infractions.
What does that mean?
So black girls talked about, you know, hey, I asked a question in class and somehow my teacher's reading it as defiance, but I'm just asking a question. Or, hey, I'm wearing the same thing to class as the white girl next to me, but somehow someone's saying it looks different on my body. Hmm. So what we're seeing is that black girls are actually being disciplined for who they are and not what they're doing. And also, you know, our school's inability to deal with things like sexual harassment leads to these situations where black boys and black girls are getting pushed out. So, for instance, you know, we talked to a young black girl who was saying, you know, this boy in my class kept looking up my skirt. And I kept asking my teacher for help, but she wouldn't do anything. So finally, I kicked the boy, we got into a fight, and we both got suspended. So, you know, our school's inability to really look at what's happening to girls is actually leading to push out for both genders. And then what we see is that once girls are pushed out, they face a lifetime of social economic challenges. So, you know, the median wealth of a black woman with children is $0. I don't think a lot of people understand what median means. That means half of the black women actually have wealth that's less than $0. And because black women are the primary caretakers in our community, it should be of great concern to our entire community that black women are in such dire economic straits. You know, it's just sort of foolish of us to even think that we can advance the needs of just black boys without looking at the mothers who are raising them, who are the only group whose unemployment rate did not drop last year. They face a variety of, you know, institutional violence. You know, Rekia Boyd was, you know, her 21-year-old who was killed in Chicago, and no one knows her name. The police officer who killed her, the charges were dropped this week, and we haven't seen any media about it. So it's really about sort of uplifting all of these challenges black women face across the lifespan. I'll let Annika sort of elaborate on this to help people gain a really deeper understanding of what those challenges are and the ways in which it's actually central to our understanding of racial justice and is central to wanting to advance the needs of black boys as well.
You know, so, Rachel, you said a lot. So let me try to parse some of it out here a little bit. I mean, and I think let me start here. There's always complexity because of misogyny and the way we deal with human society. It's always there. But the overlay of racism, not just race, but racism in America and in the West, makes it even more complex. And also that makes it complex within the black community about men and women and the role and roles and attitudes and expectations. So, I mean, it's a very layered, and then you have from the outside, as Rachel was just talking, of the kind of oppressive system that attacks black young black women and black girls in different ways just for the mere presentation, just because of the way people speak, because of the tone of voice, because of a method of delivery verbally, you know, Annika. I just think so. I'm curious. This is important to get these stories out, but I think because this is the beginning of a different kind of struggle of awareness that I don't think exists at this moment in our society.
Right. I mean, I think you spoke to the complexity of intersectionality, or as right. I say, sometimes being a black woman experiencing racialized sexism or sexualized racism. I mean,
right.
they're operating differently at different times. But I think the struggle now is just raising awareness that there are gender-specific burdens. So if you're talking about the black community's engagement with the criminal justice system, for example, it may look differently for black men than it does for black women. Mm-hmm. I think one of the most powerful stories I heard in the build-up for this town hall on Saturday came from a woman, Andrea Harrison, who was incarcerated and released, and she now works with organizations that help returning citizens enter into their communities. And she was sharing with me that the majority of organizations who do that focus on men.
Mm-hmm.
And she has a very hard time finding places to send women who are returning for help, because she says people assume, well, they've got families there to take care of them, and they don't. And I think that's one of those gender-specific burdens that's impacting the lives of women who have been incarcerated. And she also said that after she did her time in prison, she was released to a halfway house, and she said that experience was more frightening for her than the period she spent imprisoned, because she was not allowed to lock her doors and it was a mixed facility.
Wow.
And she was very frightened about what might happen to her as far as assault, having men housed with her at the same time. So might we look into having halfway houses that are segregated by gender just for feelings of safety?
Yeah, that's crazy that somebody would express having a better experience in prison than in a halfway house. That's crazy.
And the idea of a halfway house not being gender specific has kind of blows my
mind
as well.
I didn't know. I mean, that's that raising awareness.
When you're incarcerated, you have to have the locked door, but when you're quote unquote freer, you cannot lock your door.
Right.
And even in a mixed facility.
Right.
That's crazy.
Yeah. No, that to me is absolutely shocking.
Yes. I was shocked.
Yes. And I think that's what's so scary about a program like My Brother's Keeper, because, you know, all these cities are throwing out big numbers, like, okay, we're putting $20 million towards black men and boys. You know, the president's putting $200 million towards black men and boys. And this isn't new money on the table. This is actually a diversion of existing resources that went to serving the entire community. So we're literally seeing institutions that once served women or knew how to serve women literally shutting their doors or transforming their programs from programs that either serve exclusively women or, you know, black men and women to just serving men, because that's where the funding is. And they literally have to make a decision if they can keep their door open or if they're going to continue to sort of, you know, try to serve black women. But the funding landscape, it just creates such challenges around that.
I mean, these conferences are important. And I'm glad it's happening here. I'm glad it's happening at Morgan State University. And I think that all that's important. And the fact that Rachel is helping to organize these things and bring them from New York to places, communities like ours, I think is also critically important. I'm curious what we think is how we take this further than that. You know, I'm curious from your perspective, Jared, as a man, but I'm curious in a broader perspective here about, you know, how we begin to create this conversation and push this into the mainstream for people to start beginning to be aware of what's around us. And that's always the leap that has to be made, it seems to me, you know, because we don't. Yep, good. Let me just stop there. Annika?
I would say this is, I think, the brilliance of what the African American Policy Forum is doing and in working with Rachel to bring in policymakers, to bring in politicians, to bring in experts from nonprofit organizations. I think on Saturday at this town hall, we have a time to have a very substantive conversation to then push the envelope and move things forward. And I've already gotten emails from people who've heard about the town hall that's coming up that wanted to get involved, like, what can we do as far as next steps? And I think that it is wonderful, what can come from this. I don't think it's going to stop on Saturday. It's not supposed to be an event that happens at 12 and 4 and we go home and move about our day, but it's having concrete next steps come out of this event is, I think, the most powerful thing that's going on with these town halls.
Yeah, so I think that is really what is amazing about the town halls is we're basically bringing the public together and policymakers and philanthropists to really listen to girls' stories. I mean, I think one of the challenges, people just don't know what girls and women are going through. So the first step is really creating safe spaces for us to talk about women and girls for like 4 hours at a time. I mean, you know, I used to do this, you know, experiment where every time I go into a meeting, I see how long I can get the conversation to stay about black women and girls before it'll go to boys. Like, you know, at this rally, we started chanting Black Women Matter, and we got through maybe 5 chants before we went to Black Men Matter. Like, it's just really hard for people to focus on women and girls for a long time. And so I think creating these spaces where people are really forced to listen to women and girls' stories and really sit with them and see the amount of pain and suffering and scarring that women and girls have gone through is really, really powerful. And I think one of the things that also helps do is people, I think, sort of think that this is a side conversation. Like, okay, this is, you know, the main conversation is men and boys, and women and girls is like a diversion, like, you know, but it's not central to the movement. And so I think the other thing that this conversation helps do is really help people understand the ways in which none of us are going to get free until women and girls are free. They are literally raising our communities. Therefore, they are central to the well-being of everyone. So I think this conversation really helps people understand that as well. And I think, you know, it's to me, like, you know, I think it's an interesting moment in history in which people are just talking about men and boys. Like, during slavery, no one was saying, hey, just get the men out and then we'll come back for the women later. Like, this is a really new moment. And so I think we're trying to push back on it now and create spaces for people to understand understand the stories now and the ways in which us not building a comprehensive analysis of what's happening is damaging to everyone.
And I so much going through my mind just hearing that all of you have been saying about this, that, you know, I think that when I think about the movements that have happened in American history, the political movements in American history, if I think about the Panthers, if I think about SNCC, just pick two, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and the Black Panther Party. And even there in our history, whenever we think of the icons in those movements, we think of the men in those movements. Mm-hmm. They're the names that come to our you hear Stokely Carmichael or you know, Kwame Ture, but you don't hear Diana Nash, right? And it's the same thing in the Panthers. As Rachel and I were talking about yesterday, 60% of all Panthers were women. And actually, when things got hot, women ended up becoming the leadership in the organization. And so, but that's never part of the history. I think, Annika, that's a piece. And Jared, let you go and go to Anna. That's part of it. I mean, because women are just like black folks are wiped out of history. Women are wiped out of history.
Yeah, I was thinking of that book that Kamosi Woodard co-edited a couple not long ago. When you want to start a revolution, and with a picture of Rosa Parks on the cover, looking at, while she's at, I think she's at a Garveyite meeting, looking at a Malcolm X newspaper or something about. Anyway, but the point in the book is that they trace all of these women who have been erased from this struggle and the intersectionality of the struggles as they dealt right. with sexism and nationalism and so on and so forth. And this is of course, a repeating pattern that this issue about black girls is a part of, that it's obviously connected to. You know, I was also thinking about the fact that, you know, a couple of years ago, it's not that long ago, that some friends of mine included were included in that brief moment of the We Are 44%. It was a response to a Too Short video where he was encouraging young men to just in school to just when they wanted a woman just to take her, just to push her up against the lockers and insert fingers, etc. Yeah.
Oh
yeah. He was very graphic. And Double XL ran this as sort of like a promotional ad. I mean, it was a wild moment. So as a response to
Double XL.
Double XL is the second leading hip hop magazine. Okay, one of the leading hip hop magazines.
I have to ask for people like me who don't know.
I apologize. right. And this We Are 44% group formed around the fact that 44% of black and brown girls are sexually abused in one form or another before, I think, the age of 18, something like that, which I remember being wildly struck by. I had no idea it was severe. And if I could just quickly say that when I first saw this Black Girls Matter report, the first thing that I noticed, aside from the subject matter, was the aesthetics of it, that it's a beautifully put together report I bring that up only to say that I think it does its job of grabbing the attention. It's a good media piece. It's designed. The layout of it is in such a way that it encourages one to look at it, and rather than being overwhelmed by, oh my God, another huge report with all these numbers. I mean, it's very well done, and I think that's a good part of a strategy to sort of break through some of the media wall that's put up in this moment. And then very lastly, I think that one of the ways in terms of concrete steps, which I never know exactly what should be done, other than getting people in the room as this is being done with this town hall, making these issues known and having people share their stories. And then once those rooms are created, I think those are the best moments for people to decide about organization, next steps, and to impose themselves. And if we look at the moment now that we're in now with Black Lives Matter and the police brutality protests, I think one of the instructive things that we can gather from this is that organized mass protest is a way of imposing ideas and concerns onto a large population, and that people might think about infusing Black Girls Matter report and content into these movements, or creating new ones around just these reports. And we're going to get into the streets and make noise until the girls and women in our community are being properly addressed and their concerns will be properly dealt with. But it seems to me that that's one way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to reference the late Marshall McLuhan in terms of media studies, I mean, that was one thing he said, that he would not to equate what people are doing in the streets with terrorism, but he was saying that terrorists have as their only means of smashing that media wall, aggressive action. So obviously I'm not suggesting that, but I'm just saying that aggressive action is what I think is necessary to break through these walls. Because as good as these reports are, as good as these hashtags are, as good as these statements and these radio pieces are, it's the movement of people in the streets that I think really gets these kinds of things the proper attention.
No, I totally agree. And I think we've done a really good job of embodying Black boys' stories. Like, we have the hoodie. You know, we say hands up. We say, I can't breathe. But, like, what would the equivalent look like for Black girls? I just think we haven't taken the time to think about that. Yet I think it's so central. And even just, you know, back to your point about Rosa Parks, like, people don't understand that the history of the Montgomery bus boycott was that Rosa Parks came to organize around a young woman who'd been sexually assaulted by a white mob.
That's right.
You know, and so I think our perception of history stalls us from being able to think about what it looks like to embody Black women's stories now in the way we do Black boys and Black men.
That's a good question. How would we do that? How would we replicate the hoodie or the hands up?
Someone needs to create that. Yeah, we don't have
really
that
idea.
Yet.
Somebody out there listening, make that happen.
I think that points to the erasure of Black women and girls.
Right. On our way to break, we're hearing Georgia On My Mind by Ray Charles. On this day in 1979, this song became the official state song of Georgia. How times changed for Georgia.
Georgia.
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and you're listening to your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And that's Have You Ever Seen the Rain by Creedence Clearwater Revival. Doug Clifford of Creedence Clearwater Revival was born on this day in 1945.
We don't pay as much attention, or do not pay the media attention, to when these things happen to Black women and Black girls in communities by the police and others. And there's all And also, so much of the stuff that happens in sexual assaults are done away from the public eye.
And I think I'm a philosopher by training. So there's a field in philosophy called epistemology, which is the study of knowledge. It's like, what can we know? How do we know? And some philosophers that I admire talk about epistemic privilege. Like, whose testimony do we believe? Right. Whose memories do we believe? And there's a way that knowledge can be erased, and I think if you've got male privilege and misogyny, that serves to silence the stories of women and girls, or the testimony of women and girls. So we don't have any symbolism. There's no need for symbolism because they're not there, and it's not capturing the media's attention. And I think there's some work to be done there, just around knowledge and memory and testimony.
You know, the more I think about that, I think that maybe some of the response is also, because of how we consume things, is a creative response. And by that I mean, it's really you know, is really taking women's stories and women being at the forefront of stories that are created and begin to making that happen to put that into light, because I think that that's what often grabs people is this is what the creative class puts out is what people pay attention to.
Yes.
And I think that there's so much profound stuff there and so much powerful stuff there. During our day in history, I was hearing what you just said, Rachel, about civil rights movement, Rosa Parks, but, you know, there are people in that are totally forgotten in the civil rights history, like Septima
Clark,
who taught Rosa Parks, who taught Ella Baker, who was out there in the beginning and did things that nobody else did and was at the forefront of this stuff, you know, and her whole story of having an African-born enslaved father and a free Haitian mother and how that made her who she was. We never hear that name.
No.
Right?
No. Mm-hmm. No, I mean, it's amazing. And I'm really stuck on this point, though, that Annika, you're making about the erasure and we can't even come up with a symbol, because I'm still struggling.
Yes,
come up
right.
with a symbolic act to represent the struggle of these girls and women. I was struck, you know, we did a Black Lives Matter. We joined one of the protests out near our house in Howard County. And at one point, my 7-year-old daughter was holding a sign for Ayanna Jones as one of the names listed of black girls killed by police in Detroit. And she herself was 7. And my daughter, as she was reading this piece, recognized for the first time that she was holding a sign representing a girl who was her age.
Mm.
And it was just very heavy for her. Yeah. I mean, she was like, you know, wow, Ayanna. And even the other day, we're walking home, she's like, Ayanna Jones was my age. Ayanna Jones was my age. Ayanna Jones was my age. Our neighbor had the police bust into their house and put a gun to the 8-year-old daughter who shares our bus stop a year or so ago. Oh, yeah. The ATF flooded our street, bust down my neighbor's door, put him and his wife out in their bed clothing, their
night clothes.
The night clothes or whatever. And had run through the house looking for a member of the family that wasn't even there. And they found the 8-year-old daughter and had a gun in her face. So, I mean, even and we live in the suburbs, you know what I mean? we're in Howard County, you know what I mean? And so all of this is everywhere. And I don't know. I don't know exactly where I was going with that other than this trying to think of this symbolism and seeing my 7-year-old recognize that someone her age, and she's still struggling around, how could someone my age be killed by a police officer? What possibly could I be doing that would create that or create our neighbor having a gun put in her face? And yet, as we're all talking here, these stories don't get appropriately added to the mix. And it's frustrating. It's crazy.
So, Rachel, can you pick up on that? I mean, this whole idea of the symbology of all this, the symbols, and how we get to that.
Yeah, I mean, I think we really need to build frames to understand what's happening to black women and girls. Specifically, you know, I'll talk about in relation to police. You know, as we've begun, we're going to come out with a report next month that will look at this issue. But when you really look at the cases of black women being killed by the police, there are patterns. Like, black women are often killed in relation to domestic violence. Like, you know, they'll call the police over a dispute in the home. The police will come, see this, you know, quote, crazy, angry black woman, and will kill her. They'll see her as the primary aggressor, even though she's a victim. The same thing, we see a lot of issues with black women getting killed over mental health issues, you know, such as Aura Rosser or Tanisha Anderson. Both of them were killed under circumstances in which their family called 911 for help because, you know, they suffered from mental illness. And again, the police came and saw this crazy, quote, crazy black woman as a threat. So there are ways in which stereotypes about black women extend to the ways that they relate with police. And I think we have to continue to put frames and patterns to help people really gain a deeper understanding of what the symbolism could look like. And I think that, you know, it really begins with the fact that there's a knowledge desert around these issues, a huge research gap. And so we have to take the time to gain a deeper understanding of what black women and girls are going through, which is part of the reason that we've launched this town hall.
Real quick, you guys had put together a hashtag photo, Black Girls Matter, hashtag Black Girls Matter, with the caption and the photo of a black girl with her head in her hands. And it said, in quotes, "Our girls are not just fine."
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking that, you know, I was just thinking that I think that's a good place to start. I'm still stuck on the symbolism piece of blowing those up onto T-shirts, onto placards, and having those added to the mix of existing protests, because I think it's a striking image and point being made that the tendency is to say, oh man, our girls are just fine, they'll be all right. The boys have real issues, and you know. Anyway, so I thought.
Yeah.
No, I think that's a great point, and I think that stems from this notion of the strong black women. Black women are resilient,
right,
was used during slavery to allow people to oppress black women and not feel guilty about it, or to, you know, to justify the oppression of black women. And so now I think we've internalized these stereotypes, even as women of color, and said, you know, I think we have the tendency to say we're fine, you know, we're strong, we're resilient. Like, we go to that so quickly with black women and girls. And I think that's part of the problem, is that, you know, we aren't connecting that notion of the strong black woman to its true origin, which were around, you know, justification to perpetuate violence against them.
I think for some of this, we do need to work at both the macro and micro level. So we've got street organizing in this town hall. But if you kind of get back to that epistemic privilege, and also internalized oppression, because I teach women in gender studies here on campus, and I see young women struggling with some of these issues. So some of this information is new to them, where they're not even aware of the levels of their own oppression, and seeing some eye-opening and awareness happening there. But it takes, I mean, the semester is 15 weeks, and it takes 15 weeks of me hammering away at both the male students and my female students, trying to get them to see some of the systemic inequities that happen between black men and black girls, or women, black men and black women.
Yeah, I'm on that too. Like, I got 15 weeks to make you a revolutionary.
I know.
This is my first line. Like, how are we going to do this in 15 short weeks?
I think one of the best things I've done Charles Mills is a philosopher I really enjoy.
Absolutely.
And he has an article called White Ignorance, where he talks about the epistemic asymmetry. So he'll say, like, the colonized know the colonizer's language and their own. They know the colonizer's religion and their own. Where the colonizers, you have no idea what's going on with the people in the country that they've invaded. And everyone's nodding in my class. They get it. Yes. Then I turn to feminist epistemology, and I say, okay, well, there's some things that women know that men don't. And they're like, wait a minute. You see this? There's this big divide. Like, what are you talking? And it's funny, because I catch the eyes of some of my female students. They start laughing. It's like, you see, I mean, the blindness, it comes up where they cannot see their own privilege. So I think sometimes you just need to be on the ground with these one-on-one conversations to try and awaken people, men, my brothers, to some of their privilege and how that privilege operates and then serves to stunt our growth in humanity.
I mean, we need it too, straight up. I've had to rely on several important women close to me in my life to check me on what are blind spots around feminism and women's issues. And even some of us who claim we're some forward-thinking people get caught up. And then even more selfishly, becoming a father of daughters has really challenged me to awaken to see what's really going on in ways I don't think I might have had I had boys or no children at all. So, I mean, we do need help. Men, we do need help.
No. You know, and I think that when you think about when you say we do need help.
Yeah, man.
No, because I think that it's a struggle for any human being and humankind to change behavior. And behavior comes from not just your parents, but from thousands, hundreds of years and thousands of years of society and family. And when you think about how deep racist thinking and feeling unconsciously exists in the human mind, not just in America, but on this planet, because of 500 years of a racist philosophy taking over the world, right? And because that's pretty new in human history. But when you think about the way the place of women in history and misogyny in human history, that's as old as human history itself. So, you know, I mean, so that when you talk about the layers inside of people's consciousness and their unconscious and how we move and think, you know, about why men might the first thing a man might do is look at hips instead of eyes and listen to a voice. Mm-hmm. Right. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. I mean, the things like that, it's deep. It's not
deep.
Like it's really
those
deep.
Other men, by the way.
Not, yeah, right,
not,
right.
Not you.
Yeah, yeah, right.
No. I got lots of eye contact today.
No, but that's real.
When I talk
real.
To young men, I mean, I get into that because, I mean, you have to get real with young men about how we all feel and how we act and what we have to do to wrestle with ourselves. And that I mean, I think it's so fundamentally deep, which is why, Rachel, I'm thinking of the work you started. I mean, you have a lot, there's a lot cut out here for us to make this work.
No, I mean, most definitely. I mean, I think we even have folks who, you know, men who describe themselves as feminists and have the language around it. But again, I think, as Annika said, there's some real blinders. And I think, you know, it's really a conversation around allyship in a lot of ways and what it looks like to act as an ally. You know, to constantly be checking yourself, because I do think there's a way in which a lot of men who identify as feminists think they've arrived on these issues.
Right.
And there's no arrival point.
What did you just say? There's no arrival point? Is that what you said?
Yeah.
Not yet. There's no arrival point.
Not yet.
So,
Annika.
You know, ally's a verb, not a noun. Yeah.
I like that. I might take that. I like that.
I like that too, Rachel. That's good.
I think I'm reticent to say it because of Rachel saying that we always end up talking about the men, because it is very hard to stay focused on women. But in March, we held a conference here on masculinities, and we talked about it here on the show. But I think it is important to interrogate what masculinity looks like, because part of that does, as you were saying, it embodies patriarchy and misogyny. And there's also harsh punishments for falling outside of what the norm is for a masculine male. So we do need to open that up to allow for men to be allies and to express their masculinity in ways that are affirming for women.
I agree. And let's bring it back to that and bring it back to the power of these stories. And I really want, if there's a way, since we don't have the stories recorded, nor can we play them here today, but to give a sense of the power of these stories for people listening, think about this conference tomorrow.
I would ask Rachel to, yes, because she's heard more of the testimonies than I have.
Rachel, do you want to start?
Yeah, of course. I mean, we have, you know, young women talking about, you know, we have a young woman that we worked with that talked about, she was from Los Angeles, actually. I'll give you this story because I think it's a good segue in what's happening in public schools across the country. But Los Angeles doesn't have any policies around bus passes for students. And so she literally had to wait at the bus stop every day and beg the bus driver to let her ride for free. And so sometimes, because of this, if she didn't meet a bus driver to be willing to do this, she'd be late to school. And there'd be a police officer waiting outside the school as kids were, like, tardy, passing out truancy tickets. So, you know, let's just think about this fundamentally. She's trying to get to school, and she's getting punished for trying to get to school. So eventually she accrued, like, I don't know, 20 tickets. You know, she's 15, so she didn't know she was supposed to pay them. And a police officer literally came into her classroom and arrested her, and she ended up in solitary confinement for a month.
What?
So they're pushing her out of school further because they're punishing her for not going to school. Like, it's just so fundamentally messed up. I mean, and you know, this is happening to 15-year-olds, and then we look at what's happening to girls even younger than that. I mean, there was a 6-year-old black girl in Texas who was, again, handcuffed by a police officer in her kindergarten class over a tantrum she had about a jelly bean game that they were playing. So this happens to black girls from the moment they're born and then extends throughout their womanhood. I mean, we talked to we're going to have a young woman testify at the event on Saturday that's going to talk about being shackled during pregnancy. You know, women who are going to talk about, you know, again, being arrested over domestic violence, you know, situation in the home. So they're the victims, but they're getting arrested. So, you know, there's a range of stories and just a range of complexities to the challenges that black women are facing. And you know, I think one of the prime issues is that black women's stories sort of fall into this classic issue or problem of sameness and difference. And so because a lot of the things that black women go through are the same as black men, we just don't feel like we need to include them in a discourse. Like, we're implicitly talking about them, like when we talk about police violence, even though we're not naming any of their names. And then when black women go through things that are, you know, specific to their experiences as black women, such as what I talked about in relation to domestic violence and shackling during pregnancy and rape, it feels so far off the discourse of our current conversation about racial injustice that we don't even know how to tie it to racial injustice. And so part of this issue is really figuring out, how do we center black women's stories, which begins with letting them tell the stories. And I think, you know, what's so sad, I'll say, and maybe this goes back to the conversation around, you know, how we get men to understand feminism, is that, you know, we're calling for the inclusion of women and girls. But by calling for inclusion, we're accused of being exclusive. You know, even though we're just saying, hey, what about black women and girls too? People, you know, see that as us being, oh, you're just playing oppression Olympics, you've got this race to the bottom mentality. It's like, no, we're just asking for black women to be included alongside black men and boys. But it's really hard for people to get that.
Yeah, I think that's something about what you just, the final couple of sentences you said, Rachel. I was thinking, Annika, about when we started talking about the White House project around boys and young men. And I'd like to get your thoughts about that very specifically, both of you. Whether that was, in fact, do you think, a mistaken strategy to kind of make that the focus as opposed to making the focus on what? On young people in general and what happens because of race in our society. I mean, rather than, what does that do it that way?
I think it would have been a bold and courageous move to do something like our Children's Keeper. I mean, to do something that was inclusive of both genders. If you're going to give foundation money and philanthropy and invest in black people, I think it should have been a collective effort. And it's actually, it was the pushback that came from the African-American Policy Forum that brought them to my attention, because I wasn't aware of it until I was, frankly, appalled by my brother's keeper. And I was happy to stumble upon this organization and then be able to join up with them to fight back against it, just to raise awareness to the issues.
Rachel's organization.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, to raise awareness around the plight of black women and girls. And then again, I don't like on the national stage to have this the fighting that we see with the, okay, President Obama, please include us in this. I mean, that's also played out on the stage. And then to see, which I think Rachel can talk about too, Michelle Obama unroll the efforts that are going to be happening for globally for women of color while excluding black women from my brother's keeper, which was interesting to see.
That is interesting. I didn't think about that. Go ahead, Rachel. I'm sorry.
Well, and I was going to say, I think what people don't understand about my brother's keeper is that they look like them focusing on black men and boys is not because they love black men and boys. It's because by focusing on black men and boys, they don't have to talk about systemic racism. Because essentially what that program says, I mean, the whole structure of around it, it's largely a mentoring program, largely a program that is focused on fatherhood. And essentially, like, the underlying message is that if black boys would just get a belt, you know, just pull themselves up by their own straps and show up in their communities, then their problems would be fixed. So it's not about white supremacy fixing itself, that program. It's really about black men fixing themselves. And so that is why we've seen folks like, you know, the Ferguson mayor signed on to my brother's keeper. The mayor of Ferguson, like, he signed on to my brother's keeper. Bill O'Reilly signed on to my brother's keeper. Colin Dean signed on to my brother's keeper. Like, all these people who have been explicitly racist like the my brother's keeper frame because it undermines systemic racism. And so what we have to get people to understand is that this frame is not about loving black boys. It is about criminalizing black boys and coming up with individual programmatic solutions to the inequities we experience as a whole, as opposed to systemic conditions that we know are impacting black men and women together because we live in the same communities together. So, you know, the focus on black men and boys is very intentional in that sense. I mean, we just came out with a report that is called Toward Our Children's Keeper in conjunction with the Institute for Women's and Policy Research that looked at all the data that was used to justify the male-exclusive focus in my brother's keeper. Because, you know, one thing you hear across the board is people keep saying, okay, well, men and boys are doing worse. That's why we're focusing on them. Well, we looked at the president's task force itself, and the vast majority of data in that report is not actually gender-specific at all to black boys. It's all gender-neutral stuff, like indicators like poverty, likelihood to go to failing schools, likelihood to grow up in single-parent households. And that all makes sense because we know that black women and girls and black men and boys are growing up in the same community. So it would make sense that most of the data about them would be specific to the community as a whole. And then of the few indicators, I think it was like 26 out of 100 and maybe 25 were specific to men and boys. But when we looked at parallel data for black women and girls, which wasn't included in the report, we found that in about a half of them, men and boys were doing better, and about a half of them, women and girls were doing better. So this whole idea that it's because black men and boys doing worse, and that's why they've started My Brother's Keeper, is completely not true at all when you actually look at the data. And so then we really have to ask ourselves, okay, if it's not because of the data, what is it? And then I think we go back to this whole rhetoric around which the president's initiative is built around, which is very much, again, a program that criminalizes black boys and blames them for the challenges in the community. So we have to get people to understand that this initiative is not empowering at all. It's actually undermining black male achievement.
What you're saying, Rachel, I mean, this could be the grist for the whole separate hour here on the program, because, I mean, it goes against the common feelings about this particular subject, and it goes against, you know, for most people, hearing what the president's doing and the rest. And I think because it's harder to – it's easy to talk about personal responsibility, easier, I should say, than it is to talk about the deeper issues that are causing, as new report that just came out from the Institute for Policy Studies that just came out in the last week, talking about the criminalization of poverty and why that's happening in America. You know, so it's easy to deal with that because it comes, it's your fault. You did it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, in a little bit of time we have left, can anybody come to this conference on Saturday?
Yes, it is free and open to the public. If you go to the Morgan State University homepage, morgan.edu, it is the top left link on the homepage, which will give you information on the time, place, and where to park.
So anybody,
and if you're interested in testifying, you know, we still have places for women and girls to tell their stories, or men and boys who love them who want to tell stories about women and girls. We still have room. You can go to our website to get information about, you know, our contact information to reach out to us about testifying. The website is aapf.org. That's for African American Policy Forum.
So, and it's 2 to 4 o'clock. What building is it on?
12 to 4.
12. Excuse me.
It's in the University Student Center Theater. And there's free parking in the student garage. Free parking.
Not an easy thing to find.
It is not.
That's big.
That's big.
And coffee. Yes. We will feed you too.
And Jared just rejoined it. He had to jump out to talk to his students in class.
And promote this event and invite them to come and all kinds of good stuff.
Well, I think.
Although
you.
I gave him the wrong time. I said it started at 10. So they'll be early.
Well, if you listen to the show tomorrow, they'll know what to do.
Right.
This is Saturday at Morgan State University, 2 to 4.
12 to 4.
12 to 4. I might have this 2 o'clock in my head. I can't get it out of my head. Noon to 4, and it's really important, and a very important event taking place here, beginning of something, I think, critically important and that needs to grow. Rachel Gilmore has been joining us here, Associate Director of the African American Policy Forum, that is helping to put these on in different cities, and she's coming to Baltimore here to do this. Dr. Annika Simpson's with us, Associate Professor of Philosophy and Religious Studies at Morgan State University, coordinator of Morgan State University's Women's and Gender Studies program. And I'll say Annika's been doing remarkable work here, bringing stuff here to this campus that you don't see many places, like this one with Rachel Gilmore, who's doing amazing work around the country, and Dr. Jared Ball, associate professor at the School of Global Journalism and Communication and co-editor of Malcolm X, Alaya of Reinvention, and author of I Mix What I Like, a mixtape manifest, and can be found online at imixwhatilike.org. Thank the three of you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we're hearing the Marseillaise. That's the French national anthem, which was composed on this day in 1792. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Jour de gloire est arrivé.